You are Locked On Dodgers, your daily Los Angeles Dodgers podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 all.
Hello, Dodger fans, and welcome to Locked On Dodgers. We are part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. This is the daily podcast covering the Los Angeles Dodgers, bringing you the smart fans' perspective on our boys in blue. I'm Vince Samperio, and we have a special episode for you today. Jeff Snyder of Baseball Essential. It's not that he's not in, but we have a special one-off episode today, an off-day episode. I had an interview with Jason Turbo, the author of They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, a story of the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. So it's a little bit longer episode today. I had a full interview with him in Pasadena as he was promoting his book. I highly recommend the book for those who like reading about the Dodgers and even if you weren't alive in 1981, like I was not, it was a very fun read. And, you know, I found out a lot of things I didn't know. And, you know, it was a fun way to kind of connect with a team that I hadn't ever connected with before. But before we get into the interview, just a quick reminder to subscribe to Locked On Dodgers on the Himalaya Podcast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, every morning when you get in your car, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Dodgers. Also, today's show is brought to you in part by Hotels.com. Don't hate like your friend's trip. Book your own with Hotels.com and get rewarded basically everywhere. Hotels.com. Be there, do that, get rewarded. And now, here's part one of our interview with Jason Turbo. We're here with Jason Turbo of They Bled Blue, the story of the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. Jason, just kind of, you know, give us a little background about yourself first.
Well, you know, it's not entirely comfortable to say sitting here in front of a guy in a Dodger cap and Dodger shirt, but being from the Bay Area, I am a lifelong Giants fan, which allowed me to see this team up close. I was 11 years old in 1981 and took great delight in going to Candlestick Park to boo Tommy Lasorda. I mean, I don't know how much you know about Candlestick, but it had this kind of unique layout where the visitor's dugout was not connected to the clubhouse by a tunnel, so players had to walk across the field to get to their dugout, and Lasorda ate that up, man. He blew kisses to the crowd every step of the way, and he just soaked up all the boos that were thrown at him. It was a special moment for him, even more so than for us.
But yeah. I mean, after reading the book, that kind of plays into, you know, what Tommy was. He was a character as much as he was a manager. And, you know, this book definitely portrayed him in that way. But, you know, not in a bad way. That's just how he was as a person.
That's how it was. I mean, in a very good way, that's how he was as a person. And, you know, to move beyond growing up a Giants fan, I'm first and foremost a journalist looking for good stories to tell. And this is a great story to tell. I mean, a really good team, an interesting group of guys, and a very interesting season.
Yeah, and I mean, how long was this kind of in your thought process for a book about the 1981 Dodgers? Was it, you know, obviously there's a lot of stories, the strike and, you know, Fernando and everything, and obviously you have memories of it from a different side, but, you know, how long was this kind of in your waiting to write?
I'm always looking for, you know, next big thing, next good thing. So my last book was about the swinging A's of the 1970s, the three-time consecutive champions, which actually beat the Dodgers in 1974 as one of those championships. And probably around there, I started thinking about how good those Dodgers teams were. And that was kind of the beginning of the run of the, you know, the great infield of Garvey and Lopes and Russell and Say. And it occurred to me that there had never been a book about that particular team. So I started to delve in. And you know, as with any good topic, the more I learned, the better the story got.
Yeah. You know, how do you start, you know, getting into something like this? You know, what's the kind of your process? You know, maybe your process is different than other people's process. What was your process, you know, starting to research for this book?
First step is to read everything. Every issue of the Los Angeles Times, every issue of Sports Illustrated and the Sporting News and every one of Tommy Lasorda's books and every other book that had significant sections about these Dodgers, and even not necessarily 1981, but the history of the people who were there. Literally months worth of reading and then more months worth of organizing, through which I just build interview questions, and then ideally I sit down with the guy for 5 or 6 or 8 hours if they have that much time, and really get into the dirt of what went on that season.
Yeah, you know, and coming up with that, you know, what was probably the hardest part with this book specifically for you?
For me, tracking down all the players was not easy. I had it really good for the A's book because they had 3 straight 40-year reunions at the Oakland Coliseum. So they were all in one place at the same time. I could just go find them and then set up interviews for later. These Dodgers, you know, were all over the place. A few still work for the team. Those guys were pretty easy to find. But some are pretty far flung, and it took some doing to track them down. But I did manage to get most of them, almost all of them, and got some great stories out of them.
Was there, not to name any names, but was there people that you wanted to get that refused?
Oh, yeah. We can name names. I mean, it's not it's not a secret that Fernando Valenzuela doesn't really like to talk to the press. True. You know, he was perfectly amiable, a nice guy. Sat down with him in the Dodger Stadium media lounge while he was eating before a game, and asked him 10 different ways over the course of 15 minutes, please, just as much time as you want, as little time as you want, let's talk about this. He was not interested, and I don't hold it against him. You know, that's entirely his right. But you know, for the most part, everyone was very willing to talk.
Wow, that's good. You know, going into it, obviously you have a story in mind, and like you said, that the more you talk and the more you get, the different stories come. What's, you know, one of the standout things that you didn't expect or you didn't have in mind that kind of came through in this book?
One thing that a piece that I put together later, because I knew the story, the great story of Fernando, and we can talk about that for sure, and I knew kind of the big picture of Tommy Lasorda. But talking to each of these players individually, it became clear how serious about winning they were and how much they had put it together by 1981. And it was familiar to me because I'd just written this A's book about guys that had won 3 straight World Series, and they all talked to me about the process, not only of winning them, but getting to them, and how the mindset by the third one was different than the first one, and how you learn to pay attention not to every game or at bat, or inning, every pitch matters to everybody on the field. They knew that, and that's what made them champions. And as I talked to these Dodgers, it became clear that through the process of losing the World Series in 1977 and 78 especially, they had learned that as well. And they knew how to win. Like, they weren't the most talented team, but that little extra something put them over some better teams on the way to the World Series.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely went through a lot of adversity that year, and you know, just reading through it, you know, for me not being around at that time, and it's been all through reading, I didn't realize, you know, how not great these guys were at defense. and I think that was the thing that stood out to me the most, is that, like, you see a lot of the players now and the way the Dodgers are, and, like, I can just imagine how the fans were back, like, how fans now would be with this team back then. They probably would have hated this team.
Oh, my God. Social media?
Yeah.
I mean, Davey Lopes kicked a lot of baseballs.
Yeah.
He was not a great fielder. Bill Russell would not dive. He said he got hurt every time he dived after a ball. He wouldn't dive. Ron Say was a pretty good fielder, but Steve Garvey, while a good fielder, had a terrible arm, right, throwing to second base. There was a lot of issues with this infield defense. And man, you get Twitter on that?
Yeah.
Part of it is that the Dodgers, as an organization, made a point of plugging in players where they had needs, independent of where those players were trained to play. Yeah. Bill Russell was an outfielder. Davey Lopes was an outfielder. They were moved to the middle infielder because the Dodgers had gaps to plug there. You know, Ron Say was actually a third baseman. He was afraid that he was going to be moved to the outfield, which they tried to do for a moment until they realized they could use him more at third base. They shifted players all over the place, and it did tend to work out, although, like you say, there were a few defensive adventures along the way.
Yeah, and I think that was, you know, one of the better parts of this is that, you know, the way Tommy managed was a lot of gut instinct, like you said, but there was also a lot of elements of what you see in today's game, like guys moving around, and, you know, he had the platoon going on, and, you know, he would move, get guys, you know, he pulled the guy in the first inning in the World Series. Like, there's a lot of that going on. So, you know, what do you think this team, you know, and Tommy specifically, relates to baseball now?
it's a different world, man. I mean, analytics in 1981 didn't really exist. I mean, there were players and managers who kept detailed notebooks, right? And pitchers who would know how batters did against them in previous games and previous seasons. But there wasn't, you couldn't call up computer readouts of, you know, how this guy did against a right-handed slider.
Yeah.
You know, a right-handed slider from, you know, three-quarter angle. None of that existed. And Tommy, I mean, it was great for Tommy because, like you said, he was an instinctive manager. He played his hunches. He tried to read pitchers, how they were doing. You talk about pulling Bob Welch in the first inning of a World Series game. I mean, he might have let him go longer in the regular season. This is the World Series. But at the same time, he let Fernando go in a different game in that World Series with not that much worse a result, but somehow had this instinct like Fernando's going to pull it together. He ended up throwing 140-some-odd pitches after having struggled crazily through the first four or five innings, ended up, you know, winning the game for the Dodgers and ultimately the World Series. So, yeah, Tommy had kind of his finger on the pulse in a very instinctive manner.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure you talked to him about the strike and how it affected him and everything. You know, do you think this doesn't happen if the strike doesn't happen? Like this particular story, obviously the story didn't happen, but you know the way it ended up.
I honestly don't think the Dodgers even make the playoffs if the strike doesn't happen. They were the hottest team in baseball out of the gate, thanks largely to Fernando Valenzuela, and hit some skids in late May, early June. They had a 6.5 game lead over Cincinnati. Right around June 1st, lost almost a game daily in ground to the Reds. The Reds went on a hot streak. The lead was down to 2.5 when L.A. went to St. Louis for a three-game series. They lost two of those three games. The lead was down to half a game. And if baseball players had not decided to strike at that very moment, you know, if it happened one day later, they might have coughed up the lead entirely. And that really came to matter when, after 50 days were wiped out of the season, and Major League Baseball decided the best way to deal with that was to crown first-half champions and second-half champions. It gave us the first ever divisional playoff. The Dodgers were actually looking good in the second half. They were on a 100-win pace until about 3 weeks left in the season. Ron Say had his arm broken by a pitch from San Francisco's Tom Griffin and was out indefinitely. He missed the rest of the season. And the Dodgers from that point on went on a 100-loss pace. They had a four-game lead at that point. It turned into a four-game deficit. And they didn't win the second half championship. They didn't even finish with the best overall record. The Reds finished with the best overall record and still didn't make the playoffs because they didn't win the first half or the second half. You can bet they were angry about that. But you know, the Dodgers, you know, they came back to play in early August knowing they were in the playoffs. That's, you know, there's some motivation. Davey Lopes at the time was very critical of anyone who would question them, saying you're in the playoffs, you know, we wouldn't try hard. You know, there's not a man in here who wouldn't you know, not try to hit a home run or run hard to first base or anything like that. But it wasn't about trying hard. It was about preserving yourself for the playoffs, right? Do you need to dive for that ball at all costs when the win doesn't even really matter? Or do you need to stay healthy when the games do matter? And despite Lopes' insistence to the contrary, the Dodgers started playing that way, especially from the top. I mean, Tommy started resting guys. They started calling up a lot of minor leaguers and, you know, second-line guys, bullpen guys were getting starts. So he was definitely managing, especially the last few weeks, with an eye toward the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely stands out in this because it goes back to what you said. Like, these guys know how to win, and they knew that they had this chance already. They were already in the playoffs. They knew what they wanted to do. You know, from the sense of the guys that you talked to, you know, they were down 2-0, and then they were down again in the next round, and then down again in the next round. You know, did you get the sense from these guys that they knew that, you know, this was special and that they were going to win? Or did you feel some doubt when you were talking to these guys?
Oh, I mean, they didn't know anything. I mean, they were struggling coming into the playoffs.
Yeah.
They were on a losing streak. The bats were ice cold. You know, Fernando had you know, after his amazing start, which we'll talk about, had a real big lull and came back strong. But he was one of the few who closed the season on a positive note. There's no guarantees. And then they go to Houston and get shut down. Two games in a row. Their bats are completely silent. Nolan Ryan is dominant in the Astrodome. They flew back to Los Angeles on the verge of elimination. This was a best-of-five playoff series. Okay. They lose two. You know, you've got one more, and they're out. And they won three in a row at Dodger Stadium. You know, Garvey has said that he knew it all along. We have them right where we want them. And, you know, Lasorda was publicly confident, but you know, I think privately everyone had their doubts, you know, especially with an infield that doesn't have great defense and bats that are ice cold. They won three straight over Houston because they played really much better at Dodger Stadium than they did, especially in Houston.
Yeah.
You know, the Astros were built for the Astrodome, and the Dodgers were not, and vice versa.
All right, that was the first half of our interview. Before we get into the next half, we just want to once again remind you to subscribe to Locked On Dodgers. You can do so on the Himalaya app, which is free, easy to use, has all your podcasts you're looking for, and a variety of features that make your podcast experience better. Download Himalaya at the App Store or Google Play Store today. And if you need to book a trip, book one with hotels.com. We will be right back with part two of the interview.
All right, let's take a quick break. For the next minute or two, we're going to talk about SEX. So if you have any KIDS in the CAR, go ahead and plug their EARS for a minute, okay? Hope I spelled all those words right, and I hope you could tell what they meant. Have you ever gone to the barber and wondered why there's a bunch of gray hairs on the ground when they're done cutting your hair? Or have you ever played catch with your son and then you feel like a truck hit you for the next couple days? Or maybe when it comes to the sexy times, are you maybe just maybe a little less always ready to go than you were when you were younger? Don't answer those questions out loud, and please do not tweet your answers at us. It's none of our business. In fact, to quote Michael Jackson from back when we were allowed to acknowledge his existence, ain't nobody's business but mine and my baby. That's where BlueChew.com comes in. If you want to increase your performance and get some extra confidence in bed, check out Blue Chew. That's blue as in I bleed Dodger blue, and chew as in Madison Bumgarner likes to chew out opponents who pimp homers or flip bats or look at him because he's a crybaby and a stunted immaturity, whatever he is. Ugh. Anyway, Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. But the best part is, Blue Chew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in a discreet package, so there's no in-person doctor's visit, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, and since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. Now, this isn't just for guys who can't perform. It's for any guy who wants a boost in the bedroom, either in quality, quantity, or both. I mean, I obviously don't have any problems in that department. I don't mean to brag, but I do have three whole kids. But I have to admit, even I am a little bit intrigued. So anyway, right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code MLB. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code MLB to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring Locked On Dodgers.
All right, we are back, and because this episode's already a little longer, we're going to pass on Obscure Dodger of the Day today and just hop right into part two of the interview.
You think that, you know, I mean, Dodger Stadium's kind of been a normal stadium to a certain degree, and they did have to play in some not so normal stadiums in Houston and in Montreal. I don't know, comparing it to now, do you think like that type of home field advantage doesn't really exist anymore?
Home field advantage always exists, yeah. You know, even if it's just, you know, the umpires subconsciously, you know, giving calls to the home team. But the home field advantage for the Astros in the dome was profound, right? It was a giant ballpark. And they were a team of slap hitters that could shoot balls through the gaps and then run like mad on the bases. And the Dodgers were more or less a team of home run hitters that worked well in Dodger Stadium, but those balls were dying on the warning track in Houston. And I mean, there were a number of balls that would have been out at Dodger Stadium in those first two games that were caught. So they were really happy to get home and made the most of it.
Yeah. All right. So you said we'll talk about Fernando. So let's get into Fernando. Obviously, he's, you know, a legend in Dodger sense. And in the Mexican community, and he's still around with the team. You know, I wasn't around for Fernando Mania. You were you were alive, obviously, but a little bit different side of it. But just kind of, you know, tell us the story and the aura of Fernando that year.
Fernando came out of nowhere, and that's almost literal. Right? Yeah. He was off a dusty truck farm in Mexico, worked his way up through the Mexican leagues in a very short amount of time, got signed by the Dodgers, spent a tiny sliver of time in the minors, got called up in September 1980 as a 19-year-old. The Dodgers were three games behind Houston. I'm giving you the long story here. We got time.
We got time.
Three games back of Houston with three games to play. Stage a furious comeback again at Dodger Stadium because they played well there and Houston did not. Ended up tied. Forced a one-game playoff. Lasorda had a choice to make. Do I start our biggest free agent acquisition ever, pitcher Dave Goltz, who had been kind of a bust, or do I start this kid who had just got called up, had never started a big league game, Fernando Valenzuela. He's 19 years old. He went with Goltz. Goltz got pounded. The Dodgers lost. They spent all winter thinking about what went wrong. Well, come opening day the next season at Dodger Stadium, Jerry Royce was scheduled to pitch. Don Sutton had just left as a free agent for Houston. Royce hurt his calf the day before and running in the outfield. He couldn't pitch. Bert Hooton had an ingrown toenail that he had minor surgery on because he did not expect to be needed that day. He couldn't pitch. Bob Welch had bone spurs in his elbow. He couldn't pitch. The next two guys in the order, Goltz and Rick Sutcliffe, had just closed out the freeway series with Anaheim to finish spring training. They couldn't pitch. Suddenly, Fernando is standing on the mound as the first rookie in the 98-year history of the Dodgers to start on opening day and goes out and throws a shutout over Houston, the class of the National League. And people were kind of scratching their heads and like, what's going on with this kid? Is he for real? Next game, he goes out, pitches a complete game, gives up one run. Next game, goes out and pitches a shutout. Fourth game, goes out, pitches a shutout. Fifth game, goes out, pitches a shutout. Like, literally, by the time he had made eight starts, he finished all of those games. He threw nine innings in each of those games. There was actually one game he didn't finish. It went 10. He even got the win in that because the Dodgers scored just a few minutes after he was pulled for a pinch hitter. Five shutouts, 0.50 ERA. He'd given up four runs across 72 innings. Like, it was a wild start. No one had seen anything like it. And the fans went nuts for it. I mean, they were printing up T-shirts and buttons and posters and hawking them all over L.A., the roads up and down to Dodger Stadium especially. They were recording songs, and he was signing all kinds of endorsement contracts, and someone named it Fernando Mania, right? And the people who were there, especially the reporters I talked to, loved it because it wasn't some creation of the marketing department. It was completely organic. And the city was alive with love for Fernando, and that was important on the field, of course, because he was winning games. It was important off the field because the local Mexican community had never embraced the Dodgers to the degree that the Dodgers wanted to be embraced. Right? And that's because once upon a time, in Chavez Ravine, there was a vibrant Mexican community. Three barrios, a couple of schools, a post office, a church. In the early 50s, the mayor of Los Angeles, a guy named Fletcher Bowron, decided that he wanted to build some public housing there, a giant housing project. He offered first shot at the units there to the existing residents if they would sell him their property. Most of them took him up on the offer because they knew they would probably be evicted anyway. Before ground could be broken, plans were drawn up, like it was all ready to go. Before ground could be broken, Bowron lost the mayoral race to a conservative named Norris Polson. And it was 1950s, Red Scare, communist threat. And he labeled subsidized housing a socialist threat, scuttled everything, right? These people were evicted, they didn't have anywhere to go. And now the city had a bunch of empty land and not a lot to do with it until Walter O'Malley, shortly thereafter, said, I want to move to Los Angeles. They gave him the land, they raised the hills, they filled the valleys, they built Dodger Stadium, and the Mexicans never forgave the Dodgers, by and large. All right, so LA's last season, then Brooklyn's, the Dodgers' last season in Brooklyn, they drew just over 1 million fans. Their first four seasons in Los Angeles, playing at the LA Coliseum while Dodger Stadium was being built, they about doubled that. Once they moved into Dodger Stadium, all bets were off. They sold almost 3 million tickets their first year. It was a major league record. They kept setting new major league records. The only people who didn't want to see them were the Mexicans, right? And Al Campanis, the general manager, knew that. They all knew that, but Campanis was very vocal about wanting to find what he called the Mexican Sandy Koufax, right? The guy to activate Mexicans the way that Koufax had activated Jews. And he tried a bunch of guys, a bunch of Mexican nationals, none of whom were very good at baseball, none of whom won over the masses. It wasn't until Fernando came along that demographic was reached, and it was reached incredibly effectively. By the end of that eighth start, in fact, considerably before Fernando hit his eighth start, you know, he was 4-0 and 5-0, and there was a mariachi party in the Dodger Stadium grandstand. Like, the local Mexicans were totally turned on by this guy, and as far as I know, that devotion has never ceased, right, since that day.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the coolest story is, you know, when Mike Brito talks about, you know, how he came across Bobby Castillo with the screwball, mm-hmm. and, you know, he basically said if none of this would have happened, if, you know, a foul ball he had hit off Castillo in a game would have went foul, you know, was that story, is that something you knew about going in, or was that, you know, that came from you know, creating this or making this book?
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew the broad strokes that Brito had signed Fernando.
Yeah.
But, you know, in talking to a lot of guys, including Mike Brito, I learned that he signed Bobby Castillo, great Dodgers relief pitcher, who threw a screwball. Right? And he signed him because Brito ran a semi-pro league here in Los Angeles in addition to his day job, and ended up striking out against this pitcher. Castillo had been signed by the Royals as a third baseman and washed out of their system after one minor league season. So here he is in L.A., where he's from, playing in a semi-pro game, and Brito's batting against him. Brito himself was a kind of a career minor league player. He had a shot at the big leagues, but he injured his elbow. He was a catcher. He injured his elbow in a play at the plate. So he's hitting. He's way out in front of a couple mediocre fastballs, fouls him down the line. With two strikes on him, Castillo throws him a pitch he did not recognize. And he was impressed to the point where he had to go track him down after the game and say, what was that pitch? And Castillo said, that was a screwball. Well, Brito was also a very part-time scout for one of the Mexican League teams and said, hey, you want to play in Mexico? And Castillo certainly did. Yeah. He went down there, honed the craft even more. Brito, soon enough, hooked up with the Dodgers, got Castillo in the Dodgers system, ended up going down, finding Fernando almost by chance. He went down to scout a shortstop, ended up falling in love with the pitcher who struck out the shortstop four times, convinced the Dodgers to sign Fernando. And there's a lot of intrigue with that, too, in terms of, you know, the Yankees trying to swoop in and get him from under their noses. But he ended up with the Dodgers. And when he got to Lodi, the minor league team in Lodi, I think it was a single-A team, and didn't really show improvement with the fastball, Campana said, we need to teach him another pitch. And he called in Brito, and he's like, what about the split finger? And Brito said, we don't have anyone who knows how to throw a split finger. But actually, I do know a guy who knows how to throw the screwball. Why don't we teach that to him? So Bobby Castillo, who Brito signed, taught Fernando Valenzuela, who Brito signed, how to throw the screwball, and the rest is history. That was his out pitch.
Yeah.
And for those first eight starts, it was completely unhittable. Right? He would throw it, and it would tumble wide of the strike zone. And batters would just offer at it over and over and just miss. And when he hit a lull, it was because the league had seen him once or twice by then. They knew to lay off that screwball, and it would just dip wide of the strike zone, and they were starting to take it. And then he had a resurgent second half because he began putting it into the strike zone and dominating again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, his story is obviously crazy. But, you know, as you were writing the book, what guy who maybe you didn't have as a, not necessarily a focal character, but like a main character type, ended up becoming one of those main character types as you went on with the book?
Well, you hit on it with Mike Brito. I mean, he's the main behind-the-scenes guy who has almost a larger-than-life presence here, because Fernando moved in with him at his, you know, in his guest house in Los Angeles. He showed this kid the ropes. His own backstory is very, very interesting. And you know, he's a talkative dude. He remembers details in a really interesting way. You know, and you look at someone like Steve Garvey or even someone like Dusty Baker, who were great interviews and have terrific stories of their own, they've been in the press a lot over the course of their career. So I already knew a lot about them. Brito was an unfurling mystery, you know, the more I got to know about him.
Yeah, and he's well known for his hat and, you know, having the cigar and all that, but I don't think, and people know him as the guy San Fernando, but I don't think they necessarily know all this other stuff about him, which was, you know, obviously, like you said, it came out in this story, and, you know, he's a big part of that Dodgers, you know, those Dodgers going, and even still now, as they've been going on. So and that's a good one.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, maybe my favorite quote in the book is from Brito, kind of closing up the story about Castillo teaching Fernando the screwball. He says, you know, if I don't strike out on that screwball, I never sign Castillo. For, you know, who knows what happens? It's a difference for Babo Castillo. It's a difference for me. It's a difference for Fernando. And he closed the quote by saying, you see how destiny is.
Yeah.
I'm like, there it is.
Yeah.
It's straight up destiny.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, going through the year in Los Angeles, you being on the other side of it as a, you know, 11-year-old Giants fan, what do you remember from that time about, you know, this? Did you know, like, any of this big stuff on the story? You're 11-year-old kid. I'm not, you know.
I knew my favorite team was terrible and had been terrible for a long time and had little hope of being anything but terrible in the future. I was, you know, I was thinking about this in doing interviews for this book early on, and I realized, you know, Johnny LeMaster. I don't know if you know Johnny LeMaster. He was a very mediocre shortstop, but he was like the prototypical Giants player of my youth, and he ushered in the longest playoff-free stretch of baseball since the 1890s for the Giants. Man. 15 years they didn't make the playoffs. That was exactly my childhood. And the Dodgers were really good for almost all of it. So yeah. I just grew up knowing, A, being happy to boo them, but B, really just secretly wishing my team was more like the Dodgers.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the story of the infield is probably, you know, just that. It's not probably never going to happen again. Or a team, you know, guys play that long together. One guy that also stood out to me was Steve Yeager, who, you know, he's a coach now, and I've seen him before. I've interacted with him, and he's a character. But, you know, just to touch on him and not being labeled as part of the infield, even though he was around with them, you know, just kind of tell us a little bit about his story and, you know, maybe something you learned about him as you were writing the book.
Yeah, Yeager was there for the duration, and he was a great defender. He had a terrific arm. He was, by most accounts, the best batting practice hitter on the team. He would hit bombs during BP because he would tell the pitcher, give me a fastball right there. And he could handle that fastball right there. There were other pitches he didn't handle so well. Yeah, I mean, he hit, you know, 212 a bunch of years in a row and was kept around for his defense and his leadership and because Tommy loved him. He was probably the guy who enjoyed Los Angeles the most as far as swinging bachelor lifestyles go.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he appeared in the pages of Playgirl twice, maybe three times.
Yeah.
And a number of his teammates talked to me kind of in awed terms about how he could play baseball and live that lifestyle at the same time. But, you know, he's the guy who would be standing in the shower, naked, showering with a cigarette in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other, and then say, oh, I guess it's time to go play baseball.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely stood out to me. The other thing that stood out to me that I didn't even know about was, you know, Steve Garvey and kind of the resentment he had from teammates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one, did you still feel that now when you're talking to the guys? And two, you know, just kind of that dynamic. At the time, I wasn't around, you were around. But Steve Garvey, you know, did you feel, not resentment, but did you feel like, you know, Garvey was like kind of the prototypical guy? Or was it just maybe a Los Angeles thing?
What, you mean back in the day?
Yeah.
No, as far as I knew, Steve Garvey was just the all-American, you know, square-jawed, big-armed, power-hitting superstar.
Yeah.
For many, many years. Like that's, I mean, that, I think that's his MO across the country, except perhaps in his own clubhouse.
Yeah.
Right, and I heard, I mean, we all know a lot about his image, right? He's Mr. Good Guy. He's stick around and meet the fans and sign the autographs and hug the babies and kiss the nuns and all that kind of stuff. And at first blush, I was wondering whether teammates resented him because it was a front, right? If he really was, you know, had this secret side that no one knew about and it was totally hypocritical. It's not. Like, that's him. That's who he is and what he does, and it's what he's always done. That's one thing I learned about this Dodgers team also, is that for all the different personalities, no one fronted. No one tried to be anything other than what they were. Even you know, Ron Say being cranky, he didn't try to be anything else. Tommy Lasorda being an overt cheerleader, he never tried to be anything else. So Garvey was who he appeared to be. He did tend to, I don't know if grandstand about it is the right word, but, you know, he would give looks to teammates who would curse in front of the public or, you know, maybe had a drink or two too much because he didn't do that, right? And he sat on the bus with the coaches and the press rather than the bus with his teammates. Yeah. And he was really just separate from his team. And I think that's what built a lot of the resentment. And then, of course, also in late 1980 and 1981, his marriage fell apart. And for a guy who's presented himself as a paragon of virtue, literally,
yeah.
like that was a shock for the viewing public as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, one thing I enjoyed about the book is kind of making it interactive, where, you know, you do a good job of moving between the stories and the games, and, you know, kind of both, you mix them well. And for me, it kind of became interactive, where, you know, I read about a certain home run or a certain play, I'll go look it up on YouTube. You know, how do you find that balance between, you know, the stories and get maybe, because I think you give enough details about the games, but, you know, you don't go too much where people might get turned off by it. How did you find that medium?
It's a tough balance to strike, right? Any story, you've got to know who the characters are before you totally appreciate the story. So, I pause intermittently through telling this kind of more or less chronological story to give backstories. You know, the biggest backstory belongs to Fernando, you know, coming from Mexico and all, you know, all the stuff that went into Fernando Mania. But I try to give backstories on every key character, at least somewhat. You know, it's interesting to know where Dusty Baker came from and how he moved from Riverside up to Sacramento and the things he had to deal with there, because it helped make him who he is, right? The same is true for every player. And, you know, baseball action is great. You know, I'm a baseball fan. That's why I became a baseball writer. But when you start reading about it, you don't want to get too granular about baseball plays, at least in a book, for me.
Yeah.
Except for those plays that really were, really mattered. You know, they're like, in my last book, in the A's book, talking about the 1974 World Series, I devoted significant space to describe how Joe Ferguson, you know, cut off a ball in the outfield from, I'm forgetting which center fielder he cut off. Anyway, center fielder without a strong arm was camped under it. Ferguson, as planned in advance, stepped in front of him, caught it, rocket armed, you know, throw to the plate, gunned out the runner. That was an interesting play. That's worth devoting some space to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do that kind of stuff in this book too. But, you know, I don't want to write a game story for, especially during the regular season.
Yeah.
And you see that during the postseason, there's a little more attention paid to that kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, what kind of, you know, response have you gotten so far to the book? Have you gotten any yet? Or I know it comes out.
It came out last Tuesday.
Okay, so.
Jimmy Wynn, that's who we cut off.
Okay.
It took me a minute. I'm too busy thinking about 81. I forgot all about 74. The response has been great. I mean, the reviews have been terrific. You know, every player I've showed it to has and not only enjoyed it, but said this is the most accurate account of this season I've seen, which is important to me.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not trying to sugarcoat that team that year, and bad things went on, and people are fallible and make mistakes, and, you know, it's my job to chronicle it as well as all the good stuff that went on. You know, there's way more good stuff than bad stuff. Let's be clear about that. But if you're going to be truthful, you've got to be truthful. And I think that's kind of what makes our heroes enticing to me. You know, they're not black and white. There's a lot of gray area, and figuring out how people superseded the gray area and succeeded despite it, or corrected it, or became better because of it is really a key component to a good story.
Yeah. You know, and in talking to the players, you know, what's your approach when you talk to the players about, you know, trying to get these stories out of them? Maybe some that are a little apprehensive at first. You know, what's your approach for interviewing?
I start soft. You know, if I know I have the time, I'll talk for a good long while about all the things that are not controversial before I kind of segue into it. You know, I it helps that I have a reputation and that I've written other books, and that, you know, if they care to dig into it, they can see fairly easily that I'm fair and balanced. Wow, I'm sorry I used that term about myself. They see that I'm fair. And, you know, ultimately it's a matter of wanting to get their perspective on some difficult issues, right? I can go and talk about it without their input.
Yeah.
And, you know, I probably will if they won't talk to me about it. You know, Garvey didn't want to talk to me about his marriage. That's his right, you know? But I'm going to ask the question.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put it out there as if, you know, like, well, your ex-wife wrote her own book, right? I'm getting a lot of information from that book. This is your chance to, you know, counter any of it or all of it or say whatever you want. And if you choose not to, that's okay. But, you know, the record's going to be what the record is otherwise. Yeah. And to that end, you know, a lot of people did talk very frankly.
Okay. Last thing is, from what we haven't talked about yet, you know, what's one thing that you want to bring up about the book that we didn't discuss yet that you think will get people to want to read?
It was just a fantastically interesting season. I mean, we talked about almost everything from Fernando Mania to it was the last season of the infield, which was together almost twice as long as the next most durable infield and somehow more or less couldn't stand each other off the field.
Yeah.
Yet they'd been together for so long. We didn't talk about Dusty Baker being such an amazingly unifying presence in that clubhouse. I mean, it was more or less a clubhouse with no leaders, but when I asked that question to everyone, who is the leader? Their first answer was, well, nobody really, but Dusty, yeah. Right? He was the one everyone trusted and everyone respected. And this team didn't break down along racial lines like some clubhouses. It didn't break down along position player and pitcher lines like some clubhouses. It really broke down along the lines of when they got there, right? The core of the team, the infield especially, had come up through the minor leagues together with Tommy Lasorda. There were kind of longtime outsiders like Dusty Baker and Jerry Royce. There were kids who were coming up through the minor leagues like Steve Sachs. And it really broke down into those camps. And there were Hispanic players and non-Hispanic players, language barrier. But you know, Dusty transcended everything, right? He communicated with every single group. And just hearing the breadth of the respect for that guy was very impressive. And, you know, I knew him from his time managing the Giants.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know the respect people have for Dusty on that end, but hearing his peers talk about it was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it was kind of under the radar. Even we didn't bring it up, but, you know, he, at the end of the day, he was a big part of it. So that was a good story on his end that, man, a lot of people probably didn't know about. All right, well, thank you for your time. You know, good luck. We'll make sure to plug this out and get it out there. Like I said, I really enjoyed it, especially for someone who wasn't around, but, you know, loves baseball and loves the Dodgers and, you know, wanted to learn. And like I said, the interactive experience for me was kind of cool when I could, you know, just go back. Let me pause real quick reading. Let me go look up this Steve Yeager home run that, you know, seemingly he was hitting 212 and he ended up hitting two key home runs in that run. So, yeah, thank you for writing it. And good luck with everything moving forward.
Thank you. It doesn't hurt that the Dodgers are, you know, again, the best team in baseball this year. And it occurred to me as I'm down here for a week to promote the book, that once again, you've got this kind of wonderfully chubby, otherworldly, junk-balling, foreign left-hander who does nothing but win games.
Yeah.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah, so who knows? Maybe he'll be writing about the 2019 Dodgers.
There you go.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jason.
Great talking to you.
All right, guys, that'll do it for tonight's episode. We hope you enjoyed the interview with Jason Turbo, the author of They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the weirdest championship baseball had ever seen, the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. You can find the book online on Amazon or in bookstores. We'll put a link in the description to the Amazon store, so if you want to purchase the book, you can do so. I highly recommend it. Even if you weren't alive in 1981, you were alive in 1981, I bet you there's things in that book that you didn't know. And if you're a fan of the Dodgers and the history of the Dodgers, then it's definitely something you should check out. Also, you can follow Jason on Twitter at Baseball Codes. All right, wrapping up the show, let's get into the normal ending to the show. A reminder to subscribe to Locked On Dodgers. You can do so on the Himalaya app or wherever you think we sound best, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever app you use or multiple apps you use. If you like the show, then you have to show us. Like I've said before, there's a lot more downloads and listens than there are reviews and ratings. So we please, please, please ask if you have time. Drop a rating, drop a review. You know, give us some feedback, give us some criticism, give us some praise, whatever you want to give us, go ahead and do so. And, you know, remember, anytime you leave a review, you're automatically entered into any of our future contests. I know we haven't had one in a while, so maybe we'll bring one back next week to get you guys, you know, in the reviewing mode. While you're at it, go ahead and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Locked On Dodgers. You can follow Jeff at Snydog. You can follow me at Vince Samperio. If you want to call and leave a voicemail, you can do so 323-863-LOCK. 323-863-LOCK. We're here every weekday morning, and we hope you'll be with us. When you get in your car, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Dodgers. And remember, you don't have to agree. You just have to listen. Have a good one.
I say D-O, D-O-D-G-E-R-S. The team that's all heart, all heart and all thumbs, they're my Los Angeles, your Los Angeles, our Los Angeles. Do you think we'll really win the pennant? Bye!